Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and this hour, The Voice.
For as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all out of being alive. And here is the best part, you have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
James Kaplan is our guest. James is a novelist and a nonfiction writer who is the author of Frank the Voice. It is way up there on the New York Times bestseller list already. He has done essays, reviews, and profiles appearing in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, Esquire, and New York. He co-authored John McEnroe's autobiography, You Cannot Be Serious, a number one New York Times bestseller, and also co-authored the best-selling Dean and Me with Jerry Lewis. We're so happy to have him with us this hour as we talk about the really extraordinary life of Frank Sinatra. And he's doing volume two. This is just volume one going up to 1954. James, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, Kathleen, it's my great pleasure, my honor to be with you.
Oh, thank you. And it's our honor to have you here. I wish Frank could join us, but he will. He will via his vocals. So was he an exquisitely sensitive genius?
That is my idea about Frank Sinatra, yeah. I mean, one of the big surprises I had in doing the research for this book was, you know, Frank Sinatra has quite a reputation, and much of it self-promoted and deserved to some extent, I guess, as sort of a tough guy, blustery sometimes, swaggering a lot of the time. What I discovered in interviewing people and in reading about him extensively and looking into all his music was that, yes, he said in later years, there was an interesting quote, he said that he, when he was 9 years old, he heard the music of the spheres. And he said this quite seriously. It sounds sort of pretentious, but I think he really meant what he said. Now, imagine being 9 years old on the streets of Hoboken, New Jersey in the early 1920s and hearing the music of the spheres. I think that early on he learned, he adapted by adopting a sort of tough exterior, trying to seem tougher than he really was to mask what was inside. He knew he was a genius from the beginning.
Let's talk about his family. I love people's early lives, and he had some mama, didn't he? Ooh-wee.
Yes, he did.
She was a woman.
You know, he was 13 pounds at birth. 13 pounds, 10 ounces at birth. It was a terribly difficult birth. He was a forceps birth. The forceps badly scarred the left side of his face, his ear, and his cheek, his jawbone, and his ear was later further damaged by mastoid operation. But Dolly Sinatra, I think, decided after that birth that she didn't want to go through it again. He was an only child in Depression-era and pre-Depression-era Hoboken. It was an extreme rarity in that blue-collar town, filled with Italian-Americans, Irish-Americans, families of five, six, seven children. He was an only child. His mother was a tremendously ambitious woman. She was a brilliant woman, a dynamo. She was under 5 feet tall, fiery temper, fierce personality, fearsomely ambitious. She became a ward boss, Democratic ward boss. She chained herself to a fence once, demonstrating for women's suffrage in 1919. She made her living as a midwife and an abortionist. She also helped run her husband's saloon, which was called Marty O'Brien's. Her husband had been a prize fighter fighting under that name because in those days, Irish Americans were considered classier than Italian Americans. But Dolly Sinatra was, yes, a fiery woman, a violent temper, and Frank Sinatra later told Shirley MacLaine that he never knew whether his mother was going to hug him or hit him.
Hmm. Just like Ava Gardner years later.
Yeah.
And she, I thought this was an extraordinary thing for her to have done. You write that Dolly lifted the family out of the lower middle class. Dolly did that.
She did it. She did it single-handedly. Her husband, Marty, was a sweet man who never talked much. I'm not sure. He was a sweet man. I'm not sure how intelligent the man he was. She was able through her Democratic Party connections to land him a job as a fireman and eventually as a fire captain in Hoboken. But Dolly was the power in the family. And as I said, tremendously ambitious, and that meant socially ambitious as well. Frank Sinatra was born in what used to be called, in the pungent language of the day, the unapologetically politically incorrect language of the day, it was called Guinea Town. That was the Italian section of Hoboken. And Dolly Sinatra was determined to get out of there. So they moved. They moved and they moved and they moved ever farther east toward the Hudson River, better and better neighborhoods.
He told this story, and I'm wondering if this was something that was deeply ingrained in his psyche and forever damaging to him, or if he used it for effect, that birth, which you describe in all its traumas, was one in which they were going to save Dolly, and they tossed him aside.
You know, I think that there may have been some drama in that characterization. He and Dolly, her whole life, she died in 1977 in a plane crash, actually, crash of a private jet that was taking her to Las Vegas. She and her son had an extremely thorny, complicated, contentious relationship. I think she was very proud of the fact that Frank Sinatra was her son, but I think even more important for her was deriving the monetary benefits that stemmed from that. And Sinatra professed to love his mother, but as I said, said to Shirley MacLaine that he never knew really where he stood with her. So it was always a difficult relationship.
Mm-hmm. The voice, the phrasing, the genius that we hear when we listen to him, and we'll listen to him more, was something that didn't seem, as I was reading your book, to be very evident when he was really young. His voice was kind of thin and high. He wasn't a guy who you hear him sing and you say, oh my gosh, listen to that voice when he was a young kid.
The family had some money because of Dolly's midwifing and abortion practices. Frank had his own bedroom and his own radio. And on that big cathedral model radio, he listened to miraculous sounds coming in, one of which was the miraculous, truly miraculous sound of Bing Crosby.
Mm-hmm.
Bing Crosby was a one-man epoch in American popular music. Male popular singers that had come before him. Before the invention of the microphone, electronic microphone, singers had to project to the back rows of the theater, and men had to have high voices to get back there. So tenor voices were prized. Popular singing was very affected in those days. English accents, slightly effeminate. Bing Crosby comes along, he sounds like a man, and he sounds like a man who's telling you a story. His singing is warm, accessible, tremendously attractive. Sinatra listened as a boy to Bing Crosby and thought, I want to sing like him. But at first, you're right, he couldn't. And even when you hear the Columbia recordings of the 1940s, as his voice was beginning to mature, it's a much higher voice than would come along later on with the great Capitol years.
And as you say in the book, and you also have, we won't go into Crosby, it's not his biography, but you have very interesting things to say about who Crosby was, but that his influence on Frank Sinatra, and you can imagine him listening to Crosby on the radio, simply cannot be underestimated.
Bing Crosby was a great artist. He is written off to some extent, perhaps. There aren't any rappers, hip-hoppers today going around calling themselves Black Crosby. There is a Black Sinatra. Bing Crosby was, as one important writer said, he was the first hip white man in America. He was a terrific jazz singer. He was a great artist, a hugely influential singer. And yes, Sinatra owed him a great deal. But he also, I should say, Sinatra also owed a great deal. He acknowledged a great debt to Billie Holiday. For her incomparably expressive singing, also to the great instrumentalists Lester Young and Louis Armstrong.
Mm-hmm. The first hip white man. You've forever changed our image of Bing Crosby.
Oh,
that's
man.
Great.
Listen
I love
to him
it.
Listen to him in the 30s. He was
yes,
a fantastic jazz singer.
Yes. Oh, I think he was a fantastic singer. The other thing is that Sinatra did, and it's obvious that he did it, but I didn't know he did this. He would take a song, and without listening to the music, he looked at the words. And by golly, when you listen to him, and we will hear in a second, you know that he listened intently and said the words, and the words were almost poetry to him, so that his phrasing made him who he is.
It was not, yes, and that was so important. He always, in his concerts, acknowledged the songwriters, the lyricists, as well as the writers of the music, and the words meant a huge amount to him, as did the breathing of the song. He heard popular singers when he was young. If they were singing All the Things You Are, between All the Things and You Are, they'd stop and take a breath, and he thought that was awful. So by putting together, by building up his breath control, and by paying extraordinarily close attention to the words, he was able to make the listener feel as if he was singing to you and you alone.
Oh, and now I feel as though we have to hear him sing. Here's
Let's
A Foggy Day.
A foggy day in London town had me low, had me down. I view the morning with alarm. The British Museum has lost its charm. How long, I wonder, could this thing last? But the age of miracles hadn't passed. Suddenly I saw you there, and in foggy London town the sun was shining everywhere.
James Kaplan, our guest, his book is Frank the Voice. You can hear every single word of that song. Yeah, I sound like a fuddy-duddy now, except that I really want to hear the words to songs.
It's true. It's really, and that was Sinatra's great gripe against rock and roll, against modern music. But it's exquisite. It's exquisite yet not precious. It just, I have to say, and admittedly I'm prejudiced, but the guy just gives me goosebumps every time I hear him sing.
Does he really?
He does.
He does. Who else does?
You know, with me, I'm very, I react to art in a very visceral way. And to me, the definition of true art is always whether, it's my basis for buying iTunes, as a matter of fact. If I get the goosebumps, I buy the song. And there's so many. So I have, I have over 2,000 Sinatra songs on my iTunes.
Oh,
but
my.
I have 10,000 altogether, and my collection encompasses, I do not by any means cross out contemporary music. It goes all the way back to the early 1900s, and I can get the same feeling about Enrico Caruso or Beck.
Good for you. That's good. And he recorded 1,300 songs. That seems to me to be a lot of songs.
He left out a lot, too. You know, he was very, very careful. He was always looking for a hit. That was his prime criterion. And so he could be a little over-cautious sometimes. And there's a great list someplace, I think, of over 200 important songs that Frank Sinatra never recorded.
Oh, my. Let's take a phone call, and let's give the phone number. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use one of those, is talk@WPR.org. James Kaplan, author of Frank the Voice, is our guest, and we start our calls with Sarah from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Good morning. Hey, I heard you, I guess, on Talk of the Nation, and you were talking about his big movie, his big comeback, and that movie he was in. What was it? Oh, God, I forgot the name.
From Here to Eternity.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. But what the movie I was wondering about was The Manchurian Candidate, and he was so vulnerable in that movie, and I was wondering where that happened in his career and what kind of flack he got for playing that character.
That movie was made in 1962. Sinatra was riding high in that year. It was, however, an extremely dark movie. If I remember correctly, did not do well commercially. I think Sinatra always felt that he had done a great acting job in that movie. I think he was very proud of it. But it's a terrific movie, but a very, very dark movie. It's difficult to watch, and yet it's important. And I think a lot of people revere it for that reason.
We'll spend a little more time talking about From Here to Eternity, too, and Frank's association with the mob, which is a part of his life, and continue our conversation with James in a moment. Our number again, 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Be careful, it's my heart. It's not my watch you're holding, it's my heart. It's not the note that I sent you that you quickly burned. It's not the book I lent you that you never returned. Remember, it's my heart.
Frank, the Voice, written by James Kaplan, who is our guest this hour. And we should tell you that it covers from Sinatra's birth in 1915 to 1954. This is such a huge life that James is working on the second volume that goes from 1954 until his death. Let's spend just a few moments before we go back to phone calls, because there are a lot of myths about this, and I wonder if you were able to get at the truth. You write about the constant in Frank's life, his connection to organized crime.
He idolized these guys. I think I don't want to let him off the hook. His association with organized crime is unfortunate, and it remains unfortunate. And I don't think it's something that his family is proud about. On the other hand, his family are always eager to put it in the proper perspective, as am I. And my feeling about it from having done a lot of research is that, again, as an exquisitely sensitive kid with a tough, with a sort of feigned toughness, just so he could get along on the streets of Hoboken, and also as an Italian American in the 1920s and 1930s, at a time when Italian Americans weren't even considered white by legal standards in America, Sinatra considered these guys. He idolized them. He idolized them the way a kid, a young boy, might idolize cowboys. He thought that these were tough guys, that they were men of strength, men of honor. He once said in later life, he said he would have rather been a mafia don than anything else he had done in his
life.
Oh,
my goodness.
So it's unfortunate. And in 1947, the seduction assumed terrible proportions when he went to Havana and attended a Mafia Summit conference held in honor of Lucky Luciano. Sinatra was photographed sitting with Lucky Luciano at a restaurant table. He was also spotted, unfortunately for him, by an important columnist for Hearst newspapers, a man named Robert Ruark, who began writing a series of dispatches calling out Sinatra for his mob associations. Sinatra maintained some friendly associations with mafiosi until virtually the end of his life, well into the 1970s anyway, and it was something that he never really apologized for. At the same time, people like to portray him as having been really mobbed up. Maybe
Right. Maybe
somebody who punctured his thumb and took the blood oath. He didn't do that. And it's also important to remember that entertainers who performed in nightclubs, which used to be a tremendously important part of American culture, all ran up against the mob because the mob ran the club.
Yeah. Here's an email from Matthew. Compare Sinatra to the character Johnny Fontaine in The Godfather, especially the release from the big band contract.
Yes. Well, the release from the big band contract, Tommy Dorsey in real life in The Godfather, band leader was called Les Halley. And in The Godfather, famously, especially if you remember the movie, Marlon Brando says that he put a gun to Les Halley's head and assured him that either his signature or his brains would be on the contract releasing Johnny Fontaine. Well, you know, in fact, probably unbeknownst to Sinatra, he had a sort of godfather of his own, not of Marlon Brando proportions, a strutting tubby little guy from northern New Jersey named Willie Moretti. Willie Moretti may indeed have phoned Tommy Dorsey in a threatening way, but the truth of that story, and there are two stories about Johnny Fontaine and The Godfather, which is a terrific book and a pair of immortal American movies, but we should never forget that they're fiction. There was probably some pressure against Tommy Dorsey, but there were a lot of lawyers and agents involved. Tommy Dorsey sued Sinatra. The suit had to be resolved. All those legalistic things are not so fun to tell about. They don't make for a great narrative. The Godfather is much sexier. The story of the horse's head in the bed and the movie the movie role, that is a different story, and that is a complete fiction. The story of Sinatra's getting the role and From Here to Eternity is I could tell it to you if you'd like.
It's Ava Gardner who was behind it, right?
Ava Gardner was very important. There were really several things going on there. Ava Gardner told Harry Cohn, head of Columbia Pictures, that she would give him a free movie if he gave Sinatra the role. But we shouldn't forget that Sinatra did an incredible screen test. He was head-to-head, no horse's head, but he was head-to-head with against Eli Wallach, who had also done a terrific screen test. However, Eli Wallach's agents were asking Columbia Pictures for $20,000, which in those days was real money. Sinatra, at this point in his career, was so down on his luck that he offered to do the role for expenses. And between Ava Gardner's lobbying, Sinatra's own lobbying, you know, he would send telegrams to all the filmmakers before he got the role. He would sign them with the name of the character, Maggio. Between all that, he got the role, no horse's head.
Hmm. And then got an Oscar.
Then got an Oscar.
Something. Let's go to Margaret from Madison next. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. You could probably file my little question under trivia, but it was important to me. I really never paid attention to Frank Sinatra until I heard him sing the song, I Bought You Violets for Your Furs. His
great
enunciation was so pure that I began to almost stalk that sound in other singers. I'd request the song from bands that were playing live, and they finally told me, look, that's a singer's song, and Sinatra owns that sound.
Mm.
He owns that sound. Who can duplicate that? So
yeah.
Whatever happened to that beautiful song?
Oh, Violets for Your Furs? Well, indeed, whatever happened to so many great songs? I think the good news is that that though America has divided into 1,000 tribes, and we have our hip-hop tribe, we have our folkloric tribe, we have our jazz tribe, so many tribes devoted to music. There is an important tribe, smallish but still very hardy, that is devoted to the great American popular songs. There are satellite radio shows devoted to this music. You can still hear it if you try.
Thank you, Margaret, so much for your call. We'll take another call in a moment. You can't also underestimate the importance of Frank. Well, because Frank did it, bringing music into an age of the solo vocalist.
Yes, yes. And nobody thought anybody could do it. Back in the 1930s, the age of the big bands, the band singers were, they were an ornament to the bands, but they were not the centerpiece of the bands. And so you hear the recordings from that era. You would hear Tommy Dorsey come in and play a beautiful trombone solo for about a minute and a half. And then Jack Leonard, his boy singer, as they used to call him, would come in and sing the song. And then Tommy Dorsey would lead out with another trombone solo. And it was Tommy Dorsey's show. But that began to change when Sinatra sang with Tommy Dorsey.
Hmm. Let's go to Mike from Kenosha next. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hello.
My question is, do you think Michael Bublé is like the next Frank Sinatra, and have you heard of him or listened to him?
What's his name?
Michael Bublé.
Bublé.
Yes. I've heard of him. I've listened to him. I'm tempted to resurrect that old political debate line, you're no Jack Kennedy.
That's what I was thinking, wondering if you were going to say that. You did.
But Michael Bublé is a magnetic and talented young man, and what I ought to do here is pay him great respect for himself respecting that great music. He is a terrific performer, and Frank Sinatra is a voice never to be duplicated or really quite approached. That's all I have to say. Mike, all respect to Michael Bublé, and may his career flourish, and I remain a gigantic Sinatra fan.
There you go. We need to spend some time talking. Well, we'll get to Nancy in a moment, talking about Ava Gardner and how they tormented each other, and they loved each other, and they were heavy drinkers, and both seemed very highly sexed, and they smoked a lot of cigarettes and went to bed with a lot of different people. They were some match, weren't they?
They were. They were. I say in the book, they were an unstable chemical compound, the two of them, fated never to bond. They were not ever going to be a pair that settled down behind a white picket fence and raised babies. That wasn't what either of them was interested in, but it was the thunderbolt from the first moment they saw each other. She was the kind of beauty that comes along once in 100 years. He was the kind of performer that comes along once in an eon. And yes, they had all these things in common. And those worked both for them and against them. They pushed all each other's buttons in positive and negative ways.
Yeah. What about his first wife, Nancy Sinatra? It's hard to believe that they could have had much of a marriage because he simply wasn't around.
He wasn't around, and he was straying from the beginning. And I think at the beginning, she told herself that as long as he came home to her, it would be okay. But after a while, the adulteries just became too flagrant. My book is elaborately respectful toward Nancy Sinatra, who's still with us, by the way. She's over 90 years old. She was a beautiful woman. She was an intelligent woman, and I think that she and Frank Sinatra genuinely loved each other. It was not a marriage of convenience. I think they did love each other, but I think that from the very beginning, Frank Sinatra knew that he could never really hold a marriage together. He could never really be a husband.
Let's go to more phone calls. Thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Claire next in Milwaukee. Hello, Claire.
Hello. I heard or read somewhere that Frank Sinatra actually trained himself to sing a little bit flat because people told him that with his tone he sounded better a little bit under the pitch. I'm wondering if that's true.
I never heard that before, but then again, I don't even pretend omniscience about Sinatra. There are the great expert on Frank Sinatra's music is a man named Will Friedwald, who wrote the important study of Frank's music. It's called Sinatra, The Song Is You. Friedwald knows everything about the music. I studied it very hard. I never heard that before. I thought a lot about Sinatra's pitch. It's not always perfect. I think there are other singers who are perhaps guilty of the same thing sometimes. But the mistake most often made by popular singers, and the hardest one to hear, is when they go a little bit sharp. I never heard that about him.
Hmm. Thank you for the call. Wasn't it Crosby, you say in the book, had perfect pitch?
He had perfect elocution, but I don't know if he had perfect pitch.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little bit about Billie Holiday. It's so when you were talking about Sinatra leading everybody into the age of the solo vocalist, she wasn't in her own age of the solo vocalist. It's hard to imagine Billie Holiday being anything but the star.
Yeah, well, she was. Her career ripened much faster than Sinatra's, and maybe that was the way it had to be because she died so young at age 44 in 1959. They were the same age, really. She was a few months older than Sinatra, but she was very early discovered by John Hammond of Columbia Records and put together with Benny Goodman. So her first recordings for about a decade were band recordings. Now, but that said, there was never any mistaking the genius of her singing.
Yeah, no mistaking at all. She was something. Thanks, Claire, so much for your call. Here's an email that's come in. Was Frank Sinatra pleased with his performance in The Man with the Golden Arm?
Yes, he was. I think The Man with the Golden Arm, where he played a heroin addict, and Manchurian Candidate were two movie roles that he was especially proud of course, along with Angelo Maggio and From Here to Eternity. Hollywood told him, Harry Cohn of Columbia Pictures told him when he was lobbying for that role in From Here to Eternity that he was a singer. He was a hoofer on screen. He had done these MGM musicals with Gene Kelly. He always wore a sailor suit. That's how he was perceived, as a light entertainer. And so nobody thought he could do a serious role. I think that he considered those three roles vindication.
I haven't thought. I was just daydreaming here, thinking about Nelson Algren, who wrote that, and his wife, who taught me voice at the University of Iowa so many years ago, and she was a chain smoker, but the smoke never came out. You know, she took a big drag on her cigarette, and there was never any smoke coming out. I was just
terrifying.
Going off into that world for a moment. It was terrifying. We got to talk a little bit about World War II, because there were a lot of veterans who thought that Frank Sinatra was getting off pretty easy, and they were really mad at him that he didn't serve in that war. What's the truth?
William Manchester, the great writer about World War II and himself a decorated Marine in the South Pacific, wrote that Sinatra was the most hated man in the armed forces. He was deferred. He had a draft deferment as a father and husband. And then the end of 1943, he was classified 4F because of, the doctor said, punctured eardrum and psychological unfitness. Well, there began to be rumors that Sinatra had bribed the draft board or the doctor $40,000 to be classified 4F. I don't think those rumors could ever really be substantiated. I think more substantial was the fact that his ear really was damaged in birth and by that mastoid operation. He apparently did have a perforated eardrum. It never sat well. It never sat well with the men in the armed forces, even though he was also, despite Manchester's proclamation. He was also, he made a lot of V-discs, those records made out of aluminum that were sent to the boys overseas. Sinatra's name was painted on the side of bombers. He was popular as well as being despised, but the soldiers all thought that he was at home taking advantage of their women while they were away. And, you know,
He probably was.
He probably was.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's go to Virginia from Milwaukee. Hey, Virginia.
Hi, good morning to you both.
Thank
Boy, this is great. I just came in a few minutes ago. Glad I got on the line. Wanted to mention two things here. One was a lady who called in a few minutes ago and talked about Frankie's enunciation. Excuse me. And that's the only person I ever heard talk about that. But my own mother, who was a piano player and was very much into music, had told me years ago that Frank Sinatra was really, really, it really was an important thing to him to be able to enunciate properly in his music, in his songs. And when I hear him these days, I mean, I am an absolute fan of Frank Sinatra. I love his stuff, especially his early 40s stuff.
Yes.
And then recently, only a week or so ago, another friend of mine who is an accomplished pianist, we were listening to Michael Bublé. And, excuse me, we were actually doing aerobics to this music, and I love Michael Bublé. And I happened to mention after that song, and I said, gee, that guy sounds so much like Sinatra. His stuff is so much like Sinatra, the smooth stuff. She says, well, he learned at Sinatra's knee. And then I thought later, well, this guy, Bublé, he's way too young to have learned at Sinatra's knee, but maybe
I don't mean to cut you off, Virginia, but we've already talked about a lot of this. Did he learn at Sinatra's knee?
Well, he learned at Sinatra's record player, you know.
Right.
Yes, he's much too young to have ever really spent time even with Sinatra. But the recordings provide a great example. And Sinatra always said that he was always praised for his phrasing. But what he said was that the diction came before the phrasing.
Right. We're going to hear more Sinatra in a moment. We're talking about The Voice this hour. Frank the Voice, the book written by James Kaplan, a novelist and nonfiction writer whose essays and reviews, profiles have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, Esquire, and New York. He's co-author of John McEnroe's autobiography, You Cannot Be Serious, and co-author of the best-selling Dean and Me with Jerry Lewis. More phone calls, more music. In a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist?
Frank Sinatra, and I've Got You Under My Skin. James Kaplan is our guest. His book is Frank, The Voice. I love that song. We all have our favorites, and I have several by him, but I love that song, James.
It is just a miraculous rendition of a great song by Cole Porter.
Yeah, isn't it? And who did he choose to sing? How did the songs get to him?
He always, Frank always had hangers on. Early on, there was a man named Hank Sanicola. Sinatra, they both came from the same part of the world. They were both Italian-Americans. Hank Sanicola was a piano player from the Bronx. and a song plugger, they used to call him in those days. He would write his own songs or try to sell songs to band leaders. He realized, Senecola did early on, that Sinatra was a genius. He hitched his wagon to that star. For many years, Senecola was the one looking at the songs submitted to Sinatra. And then later on, there were others who served that role. But ultimately, Sinatra was the one who decided, and as I said before, not always correctly.
Hmm. Let's go to Tom, or is it Tom? Yeah, Tom from Viroqua. Hi, Tom.
Yes, good morning, Kathleen. Coincidentally, just yesterday evening, I was down in Madison, and I had stopped at the Borders bookstore, where they have, in one of their hallways, a poster of Frank Sinatra, a youthful photo identified as age 22, and he's got some numbers hanging around his chest.
Yeah.
And the caption, or the handwritten note on it, was that he was arrested by the Bayonne County Police for the crime of seduction.
Mm-hmm.
And so my question is, was this a youthful spoof by Frank himself at a carnival photo booth? Was this something that was later photoshopped? Was he in fact arrested by the Bayonne County Police
no.
for seduction?
And adultery. You got some stories in the book on this one.
Yeah, it was the Bergen County Police, and it was the real deal. It was November of 1938. There was a young woman Frank had been seeing. The relationship went sour. The woman, I believe, may have been a little unstable. She was very put out. That Sinatra was no longer interested in her. She claimed to be pregnant. She had him arrested not once, but twice. Once for seduction. These charges, by the way, these crimes are no longer on the books, but they used to be in 1938. Once for seduction and once for adultery. He was brought in, but he was never indicted or arraigned. But he was certainly mugshotted, and that mugshot made its way to the clubhouse wall of the Sopranos, Bada Bing.
And talk about his mom's arrest, too. For Dolly's arrest, was it for providing abortions?
Yes, she was arrested a couple of times, and those arrests were put in the local newspapers not long after Frank was arrested for seduction and adultery. And what I say in the book is, here you have all these arrests for essentially sex-related charges centering around the Sinatra family. It was not the kind of public relations that they were particularly happy about, but there it was.
Yeah. And while we're talking about sex, Sinatra was this kind of a weird story in the book, and we don't think about it in terms of men. We usually think about it in terms of women being well-endowed, but Frank Sinatra was well-endowed.
He was, and he. This is. It's not a myth. It wasn't photoshopped. It was. It's on the evidence of a number of people, including his valet in late life, George Jacobs, whom I had the pleasure of spending a lot of time with. He was legendarily well endowed. I think that, you know, Sinatra was a tremendously uncomfortable man about many things. He was impatient. He was hypersensitive. He was defensive sometimes about being Italian American. He was uncomfortable about his physical self, about the scarring on his face. He didn't much like to be photographed on the, from the left side. You'll notice that in a lot of the movies and TV appearances, he's most often photographed from the right. He had no butt at all. I say in the book, his gluteus maximus was minimus. He was oversensitive about that, too. They used to pad his sailor pants in the MGM musical.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah, they did. And this was, his endowment was another aspect. I think he was proud of it sometimes. I think that his valet said that he had special underwear made because I think it was all part of a self that was that was alternately blustery and impatient and self-disliking a lot of the time. So, it yes, Ava Gardner certainly made a couple of famous remarks about Frank's,
we can't say them.
Frank's endowment, but ultimately, you know, that wasn't what kept them together, and it wasn't what drove them apart.
Yeah, was there? It's sort of hard to figure out what he really loved in his life. Was there anything that he could do away with just about anything for the sake of himself and his career, or is that an overstatement?
No, I think it's true. I think that I think that his career, his ambition to make great music, preceded absolutely everything. It preceded marriage. It preceded love. It preceded relationships. It preceded friendships. I say in the book that his life was really, he was almost like a snake molting skins. You know, his life was a process of continual shedding of intimates, of father figures, of even Nelson Riddle. After a period, you know, Nelson Riddle and he made such beautiful music together, such great and deathless music together. But Sinatra in the late 50s grew impatient. He wanted to find other sounds. It was nothing personal against Nelson Riddle, but he wanted something different, more upbeat, brighter, maybe even a little shallower. He found other arrangers. Nelson Riddle was tremendously offended by this. He was an oversensitive man himself, but this was Sinatra. Everything was about the career.
Hmm. Let's go to another phone call. We have time for a couple more if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Randy in Antigo is next. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, a couple quick questions for you. Harry Connick Jr., I remember reading quite a few things on him as far as idolizing Sinatra. Is it true or is it fallacy that it was a big influence, Frank was a big influence on getting his career going? Also, explain a little bit about the Rock Pack. You didn't mention anything about him and Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr.
We're just doing till 1954.
The years of the
50s. Okay.
Well, one thing I can say about the Rat Pack, even though it's not contained within the time frame of my book, is that, you know, Frank Sinatra was a kind of a proto-hip-hopper. He had a posse beginning in the mid-1930s, and the Rat Pack, although more distinguished than the hangers-on, their fellow performers and very famous ones, that sort of extended that idea. As far as Connick is concerned, I don't know. And I have had some contact with Connick over the years, whom I tremendously respect, not only as a singer, by the way, but as a wonderful pianist. I think he's an extremely talented guy, and he certainly has acknowledged his debt and his great love of Sinatra. I don't know if they ever actually had contact. I'm not sure about that. I wouldn't say no. I wouldn't say yes. But you can certainly hear the debt in Connick's singing, and I think to very good effect.
Yeah, you're doing the second book now.
I'm getting started. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, James! Know this guy better than he knew himself. Let's go to another phone call on the road. Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Is it Landis?
No, it's Loris, like the college.
Loris. Hi, Loris.
Hi. If this question was asked prior, because I haven't heard the whole thing, could Frank Sinatra indeed read music? Because my understanding is that neither Crosby nor, for instance, Les Paul read music.
All right, James?
Nor Louis Armstrong either. No, a lot of great musicians couldn't read a note, and Frank was among them. However, if the fourth violinist in the recording studio was a hemi, semi, demi quaver off, Sinatra heard it. He had an incredible ear.
Huh. Isn't that great to have an incredible ear like that? What I think you should do now is, I know you're working on the second book, but you should compile a list of the songs that particularly give you goosebumps and then put it on a CD, because I want to know what you think we ought to listen to now and then just spend a couple days listening to Sinatra. What do you think? We're going to listen to something at the end of the show, but what should we pay particular attention to?
Which Sinatra songs?
Yeah.
Oh, well, here's one that I would love to mention. You know, there is a miraculous song called Day In, Day Out by a songwriter called Ruby Bloom, lyric by the great Johnny Mercer.
Mm-hmm.
Sinatra sang three versions of that song, and that song is really kind of a Rosetta Stone of Sinatra's career. The first version orchestrated by Axel Stordahl, who was Sinatra's arranger in the Columbia years during the war, next by Nelson Riddle, and finally an upbeat, bouncy version by orchestrated by Billy May. There are three wonderful versions, but my very favorite is the Nelson Riddle version, which I think is just a staggeringly great.
All right, we're on the case.
Every time.
We'll listen tonight. We're going to listen to Sinatra to end the show. James, you were a treat. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you so much. This whole thing was a treat.
Great. James Kaplan, the book is Frank, the Voice. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for all the production and Chrissy Pease for on-air work.
I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow, got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go anytime I move my finger. Lucky me, can't you see I'm in love? Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold the string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let it go. I got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow, got the string around my finger. What a world, what a life, I'm in love. Life is a beautiful thing, as long as I hold.